Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Andrew Feldman about his new book, Ernesto, The Untold Story of Hemingway in Revolutionary Cuba. It's wonderful to have Andrew Feldman with us today to talk about his new book, Ernesto, The Untold Story of Hemingway in Revolutionary Cuba. Andrew is the only North American scholar who's been permitted to study in residence at Hemingway's home, Finca Vigía. Andrew lives in New Orleans with his wife and daughter. He's taught at Tulane University, Dillard, and the University of Maryland. Andrew Feldman, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you.
So tell me, what was your first encounter with Hemingway? Do you remember the first novel you ever read when you got interested in him?
It was A Movable Feast. I guess as I first traveled to Paris, I was reading A Movable Feast. The way he made that city come alive really impressed me. I would say that was the first one, yep.
When you went to Paris to study, right?
I was actually junior year abroad in the University of Sussex in Brighton. Mm-hmm. And then it was quite rainy there, and I was getting very depressed. And so I sort of, you know, just got on. At the time, there was a ferry. And so I just got on the ferry and, you know, went to Paris. And I remember getting off the train. I couldn't believe that Paris was there, and I didn't know about it. And, you know, getting out of the metro and seeing the Arc de Triomphe. I think that Hemingway described the city so well that it helped me to experience it. I was very much impressed by his power as a writer. As an artist, I mean, I think artists allow us to experience things with greater depth and intensity. And that was the charm of Ernest Hemingway at that moment.
And so you traveled to one of his favorite places to do your real work for your first book. So talk a little bit about the place and the people. Maybe read the beginning of the book for us so we'll have a sense of how he was regarded there.
Okay. Along the windswept banks of a fishing village a few miles from Havana, there is a bust dedicated to the memory of a writer set there by its inhabitants, the fishermen of Coimar. When they first heard the news that Hemingway was dead, it felt as if they had received a blow from the long beam of their sail as wind changed and the boat came suddenly about. Still, some of them doubted the validity of the news. After all, the papers had declared his death on more than one occasion, and were obliged to retract their stories when Mr. Way, as many of the fishermen finding his full name difficult to pronounce called him, returned from the dead, indestructible and immortal, like some hero of ancient lore. Others, sneering at the headlines, rejected the suggestion, repeating itself like a vulgar joke in the newspapers and on the radio, that his death had been a suicide. In this way, they were able for a time to maintain the fiction that their friend, Ernest Hemingway, was alive and that he had never faltered in the face of death.
I love that they called him Mr. Way, don't you? So yeah. Describe that place. Is it true to his vision of it even now when you're there?
There are still fishermen there. Uh-huh. It is still a fishing village. Of course, Ernest Hemingway has made quite an impression on the place. I was able, when I was there, to interview his captain's daughter. Gregoria Fuentes was his first mate on the ship. And her name is, ironically enough, America.
Right.
So She's an old woman at this point and quite a spunky personality, really, like most Cubans do. And she was gracious enough to, you know, to speak with me, and during the conversation pulled out this photograph that I had never been published or seen before of Hemingway just sort of, you know, hunched over in the background standing at her wedding, because he was invited, because this was, you know, his skipper and his friend. He attended the weddings of his daughters. So, you know, she knew him quite well. I mean, it's kind of hard to believe that at this point that Hemingway just kind of became a part of this community. But he really did, because I think that something that's idiosyncratic about the Cuban personality is a sort of like, as a real familial people, you know, I think of them as quite spontaneous and natural also. And so when they were interacting with Hemingway and when he was interacting with them, I think that there was just sort of this authenticity about their relationship that was born despite their identities as Americans and Cubans. And I think that's a really interesting thing that is really continues to this day in Cuba. If you go to Cuba today, you are not treated as a Yankee imperialist. You're welcomed. Uh-huh. And the Cuban people will really tell you that they don't confuse people with politics.
Smart. Smart.
So, which is very difficult to do today, oftentimes. And I think, you know, politics tend to separate people, particularly in the case of Cuba. We, you know, we've been separated by politics, which is a source of great pain and sadness. But it's also, you know, an opportunity to discover a cultural counterpoint. When I was first arriving in Cuba, the thought that kept crossing my mind is we have so much to learn from each other. We're, you know, we're different from each other. And that's one of the main reasons we have so much to learn from each other, is because we have different perspectives. And yet we've been kind of pushed apart by circumstances.
You tell this great story about this photograph of him with Fidel Castro and the two most famous beards in the world right next to each other.
Those pictures are all over Havana. And what's interesting is that this is a story that we might not know in the United States, but it's everywhere in Havana. You find Hemingway everywhere. If you go in, for example, the Hotel Sevilla, there are pictures of Fidel and Hemingway like all over the wall. So, you know, as I spent some time in Cuba, I started to see this story, the admiration, the sincere admiration that Fidel felt for Hemingway, which he's talked about on numerous occasions in interviews. And basically the context for their meeting was that Fidel had just come to power and he was struggling to maintain the economy when the Americans were leaving, American business were leaving. So one of the things he was doing was trying to promote tourism. So he was invited to Hemingway's fishing tournament, and he elected to participate in that as a means of promoting tourism on the island. He was doing his job
right,
as the new leader of Cuba. But I think he was kind of, I mean, he was a younger man compared to Hemingway at that point. And, you know, while they did both have beards, Hemingway's was a lot whiter. So I think he was quite in awe of the man in a, you know, very sincere way. And Hemingway also was in awe of Fidel and very hopeful, along with most of the country at that point, that that would be a new direction for Cuba. Now, I think with this book, there's a sort of a political danger when you talk about this book. But I just think that Hemingway tried very hard his whole life to avoid politics, which I think is interesting.
There's a great distinction in being the first person to do something. And you're the first scholar who had the opportunity to do this research in residence. And you did it for a long time.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about your experience as a researcher, as being in the place where he lived, what it was like.
I really have to thank the Cuban scholars that I met and the curators, because they were extremely welcoming and helpful. and pivotal to my success in being able to pull this thing off adequately. One of the first things I did was I went to the museum and, well, first of all, I had to have permission to go.
Right.
So I went to the curator and I asked her to help me to get permission with the Minister of Culture. Also I had to get permission from the United States. So I had to pursue all those avenues. But they were so helpful and so welcoming, and they wanted this connection, these intellectual and literary connections between the United States. Cultural exchange with mm-hmm. the United States is, you know, been such a long time coming. And so they were, you know, just bending over backwards trying to, you know, help me to be able to do this, and, you know, got permission, you know, in a very intense bureaucracy government that, you know, it's a revolutionary government. So Ada Rosa, as the director of the museum there, she was so helpful, and she was able to, you know, help me to stay there for an extended period so I could do the research. And then as I started to really pursue things, one of the first things I did is, I was looking at the 9,000 books that are on the shelves of the Finca Vigía.
Wow.
And nobody had really, you know, started to look at those or really researched that at all. So I asked the directora if she had any sort of catalog, or she said, oh, of course, we have this database that we have
Hemingway's
been
library.
Working on of Hemingway's library in Cuba. And I said, oh, well, can I see that? And I said, yeah. So, you know, she handed me the Excel file and I started basically cross-referencing. I wanted to see what Cuban authors were on his shelves. And one of the ones that I zeroed in on, he had copies of the works of José Martí. He had Enrique Serpa. Enrique Serpa was very interesting to me because he had every single one of his books. When you open those books, as the director showed me, there was a handwritten dedication from Enrique Serpa to Ernest Hemingway. And I said, well, who is this Enrique Serpa?
Yeah.
Oh, well, he was, and I started to discover this was his friend over 15 years. And every time he completed a book, he sent Martha Gellhorn and Ernest Hemingway a copy. So I started to, you know, explore his works. Another person which was pivotal in my research was Oscar Marino Rodriguez, who completed a biography in Cuba. It was published by the Cuban press of Fernando G. Campo Amor. So mm-hmm. Fernando G. Campo Amor was a gentleman in every sense of the word, in the old tradition, very well raised and polished journalist in his own right. He actually was a very dear friend to Hemingway for decades. When Hemingway won the Nobel Prize, Hemingway asked him to be the one to present it to Cuba and to dedicate it to Cuba at the ceremony that they had held in his honor at the time. I mean, I think one detail that maybe a lot of people might not know about is that Hemingway dedicated his Nobel Prize medal to, they call it the copper version, the Virgen de Cobre. It's basically like the patron saint of Cuba. And it is a tradition in Cuba that whenever you want something very badly, you make a promise to this virgin. And that if the virgin grants this favor, you make a pilgrimage to this holy site, which is almost mm-hmm. like the Cuban Vatican.
Right.
And it's in near Santiago. You do that in tribute, and oftentimes you will give whatever you've won to the Virgin as a form of respect. For example, there are many Olympic medalists who just lay their medals at the feet of this Virgin in Santiago. So as the story goes, Hemingway was sitting in the Floridito one day drinking daiquiris with Leopoldina, who was a courtesan who was a very dear friend of his, and she was reading his cards. And she said, oh, you're going to have great success. He was already very famous. He said, for a book that has to do with Cuba. He said, oh, well, if that's true, then I'll give the medal to the Virgin. I'll make a pilgrimage to Santiago. And that was a very natural thing to say for any Cuban to say.
Of course.
Because he had lived for 15 years at that point in Cuba. So he said it, you know, very ordinary way. So then he actually won the Nobel Prize.
Right.
So he had to follow through on that promise. And he did, you know, I think when he won the prize, he felt quite humbled because it was actually Cuba that allowed him to return to a certain authenticity in his writing.
And simplicity.
He had struggled in his career. The famous book is Across the River and Through the Trees. It was a failure. He was lusting after a young Italian debutante, Adriana Ivancic, and he had been condemned by all the critics for that middle-aged travesty, a failure in his career. But then he had been working for a very long time on a book that had to do with Cuba, that was about Cuban fishermen. He was working on a land, sea, and air trilogy.
Right.
And sort of a very small part of the book, which was a story of a Cuban fisherman who lost his catch to the sharks, and that was The Old Man of the Sea. So that part of the book was sort of the condensed version of the whole. So when he started to show that part of the book to Mary and to his friends, they said, well, you've got to publish this. This is
right.
Great. So I think really thanks to his very sincere respect, admiration for these Cuban fishermen, Cuban people that he had been in contact with throughout the years, he was able to return to, you know, some sincerity, authenticity, purity in his writing, which he had gotten away from due to the trappings of fame and his own pride, which was significant.
not to say the least.
Yeah.
So here's a simple tale that wins him the Pulitzer Prize and then a few years later, the Nobel. Mm-hmm. And yet he was integrated with Cuban society at every level. And you bring that home. Not only did he live there a good bit of the time, he invited people to come there and introduce them to other people. And he knew people in politics, he knew writers, ordinary people in the neighborhood, the kids in the neighborhood remember him so fondly.
He was really a gregarious and effusive personality. So I think any admirer of Hemingway feels that he had a commitment to mixing with all kinds of people. And he was quite proud of that, you know, so he really was, he knew the son of a president, Maito Menocal. He was mixing with politicians, you know, policemen in the Floridita, or, you know, fishermen, people in his village. His mayordomo was, you know, just a neighbor. He was one of the first people that he met in Cuba was René Villarreal, was just a boy, actually. And because tragedy struck his family, his brother was run over by an ox cart and died. Hemingway offered his brother a job as a way to help the family running errands at the finca. He knew people. he knew all kinds of people in Cuba, really. One of the reasons he wanted to speak with the children of the neighborhood, well, he wanted to be able to get in the front door when he first went visit the Finca Vigia. The front door was locked. He was under orders from Martha Gellhorn to find them a place to live, to get them out of the hotel room that she found to be an irregular situation at that point. So the village children were standing outside the finca playing, and they showed him a trick to get into the building so that he could get on the property. But one of the reasons I think that he was so friendly with them is because he wanted to sort of make friends for his own sons, or he saw his own sons in them. He had three sons, so when he met these boys, which were about their age, he felt a connection with them. As time would go on, these children would play baseball with his sons. They would form a team called Gigi's All-Stars, which was his youngest son's nickname, Gregory. Yes, he was integrated in Cuban society.
Well, it's so interesting because, you know, you can think of him as such a global citizen, global writer. But here you see him forming an identity, fitting in somewhere, forming close relationships that lasted and lasted and lasted. And it's really quite a lovely thing to read.
There's one story which comes to mind with Carlos Gutierrez, which was his first ship captain. I think Hemingway called him three quarters blind and almost deaf. Basically, when they were trying to catch a marlin and failed when the marlin got away, Hemingway just went off on Carlos Gutierrez and, you know, just chewed him out for his failed eyesight, for, you know, not paying attention. You can see that, you know, the sort of the ugly side of Hemingway's personality there coming out. You know, he's quite probably drunk at that moment. Yeah. And at some point, Carlos Gutierrez, you know, who was, I think, about 20 years older than Hemingway and a very experienced seaman who had his dignity, he just folded up his uniform and left. At the time, Jane Mason was also along on that fishing trip. And she's a married woman who very probably had an affair, certainly a friendship with Hemingway, almost certain that she was sleeping with Hemingway. So she came to Carlos's aid and, you know, comforted him and said, like, you know, I didn't mean it, or tried to, you know, comfort the old man who she respected, and offered him a job on her yacht, so, which was much bigger. But she did so. It was the Pelican 2. And so Hemingway had to go on a trip to the United States, but as soon as he came back, he showed up one morning as Carlos was scrubbing the deck of the Pelican and basically apologized, begged his forgiveness, said, I respect you, I need you aboard the ship, and basically, I don't say humiliated himself, but he apologized very sincerely to Carlos. After that, Carlos agreed to come back, which Jane Mason couldn't understand, you know, why he would do that. And she asked him, and Carlos said, well, Mr. Way understands me as no other. And on the next fishing trip, they were visiting a wealthy friend of Hemingway's in Bimini, and the two men were bunking aboard the Pilar when the rest of the party was, like, you know, in the mansion. I think a story like that illustrates the humanity of Hemingway. And right. And really, of all of us, that we behave oftentimes with arrogance, pride in certain situations. But over time, as we're in contact with each other, hopefully we encounter a more sincere way of interacting with each other. And I think that particularly in the context of Cuba, that this is a very relevant point to bring out. You know, we might go down there with certain ideas or ways of being, preconceptions. From the other side, they might have certain conceptions of us. Together over time, we start to get to something more authentic.
It's good to bring a little humility and openness along the way,
humility.
Too.
And that's interesting enough. The Old Man on the Sea, the main idea of the book is that Santiago swallows his pride as he ages and finds humility. And this was a theme that Hemingway was finding toward the latter part of his life in Cuba and through his interactions with the Cuban people. And something that he came to admire, which was not expressed in any other earlier
right.
book, but he started to find humility as he, you know, I don't want to say in his decline, but as he aged.
I think many people do.
Yeah.
Well, it's a great story, and you have found a great story
Thank
and a
you.
Great way to tell it. We've been talking with Andrew Feldman, whose new book is Ernesto, The Untold Story of Hemingway in Revolutionary Cuba. You can meet him when he discusses and signs the book Tuesday, August 13th at 6 at Octavia Books. Andrew, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, Agnes Gomillion signs her novel, The Record Keeper, Sunday, July 28th at 2 at Octavia Books. This is rescheduled after Hurricane Barry. Organizers from the People's Institute and Jesse Morgan Owens, author of Girl in Black and White, will explore the way that black and white frames the reality of families, communities, churches, and daily lives in a program Sunday, July 28th at 2 at the Robert Smith Library. Jeffrey Baker signs New Orleans, an intimate journey through a city with soul, with photographer Tom Dunford, Tuesday, July 30th at 6 at Octavia Books. Elizabeth Williams discusses and signs unique eats and eateries of New Orleans, Tuesday, July 30th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Longtime French Quarter preservationist Anne Masson presents a lecture, 1919, A Pivotal Year in Preserving the French Quarter. Tuesday, July 30th at 6 at the Beauregard Kais House, 1113 Charter Street. Seating is first come, first served, with a suggested donation at the door. Andrew Lawler discusses and signs the paperback of The Secret Token, Myth, Obsession, and the Search for the Lost Colony of Roanoke, Wednesday, July 31st at 6 at Octavia Books. There will be an open mic reading Wednesday, July 31st from 7:30 to 10:30 at the Dragonfly, 3921 St. Claude Avenue. This is the final event in the Bloodjet Poetry Series readings. Lisa Sandlin discusses and signs Bird Boys, Adelpha Wade and Tom Phelan Mystery, Thursday, August 1st at Octavia Books. The Maple Leaf Bar Reading Series will celebrate its 40th anniversary, Saturday, August 2nd at 2 at the Poetry Buffet at Ladder Library. Poet Molly Kirshner reads Sunday, August 4th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. The Historic New Orleans Collection presents a panel discussion, Separate and Unequal, African American Struggle for Schooling Before and After the Civil War. It brings together writers and scholars to illuminate the unique relationship between race and education in New Orleans. Moderated by David Robinson Morris, founding director of the Center for Equity, Justice, and the Human Spirit at Xavier University, the panel features Fatima Sheikh, author of What Went Missing and What Got Found, Daniel Brook, author of An Accident of Color, A Story of Race and Reconstruction, and historian Walter Stern, author of Race and Education in New Orleans, Creating the Segregated City, 1764 to 1960. The event takes place Wednesday, August 7th at 6 at the Williams Research Center, 410 Charter Street. Today's guest, Andrew Feldman, discusses and signs Ernesto, the untold story of Hemingway in revolutionary Cuba, Tuesday, August 13th at 6 at Octavia Books. Don't forget to listen in next Tuesday at 7:44 a.m. during Morning Edition and 5:44 p.m. during All Things Considered for our new series, Thinking Outside the Book. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.